Hi, I'm Bob Crawford, and beginning this winter, I'll be hosting a new original podcast focused on the 2020 presidential election, The Politics of Truth. On The Politics of Truth, we'll get expert analysis from our nation's most reliable journalists, experienced pollsters, pundits, and historians. And because this is the Osiris Network, we're going to speak with musicians from your favorite bands and get their take on the intersection of music, politics, and activism. The Politics of Truth, first episode premieres February 7th. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Visit osirispod.com/politics to learn more.
I'm Ben Sawyer, and this is The Road to Now. The episode we're airing today is part of our conversation that we had live in Charlotte on January 24th, our first live show at the McGlowan Theater. For those of you guys who were there, you saw the advertisements, you know we did something a little bit different there than we did at Carborough or that we're going to do at our upcoming shows. And that's that we had two panels that were in ways related, but were also very distinct. The first one was on the history of Charlotte with Pam Kelly and Dr. Thomas Hanchett. And the second panel was on the history of NASCAR with Dan Pierce, who's a great scholar who's written on the history of NASCAR, and the NASCAR legend Kyle Petty, who we've had on the podcast before, who we love. He came out. And so because the panels were distinct, what we thought we would do is we're going to air two episodes out of that one. So today's episode is the history of Charlotte with Pam Kelly and Tom Hanchett. And then later on this week, we're actually going to air the second part. We want to do that not so much because we felt like we needed to get two episodes out of it, but basically because we know we have a lot of listeners who come in for some episodes and not others. And we want to make sure the people who are interested in the history of Charlotte can come listen to this one. And the people who are interested in the history of NASCAR will be able to find the second one as distinct episodes. But ultimately, we hope if you're listening to this one, you will also listen to the other one because the whole show was just fantastic. And our thanks to everyone who was there for making that happen. As you'll hear, the audiences were great, and it really just the energy of both these live shows was amazing, just like the one we did in Chicago. So, of course, we're excited that we have some more coming up. If you're in the Nashville area, we're going to be doing a live Road to Now podcast as a part of the Nashville Comedy Festival on Saturday, April 18th. You can go to theroadtonow.com, our live events tab, and that will give you all the information. We just announced last week that our guests for that live show, the two that we've got so far, our musical guest will be Langhorne Slim, and our conversation guest will be Tom Shadyac, who you probably know if you've heard on this podcast before, but Tom is he co-wrote and directed Ace Ventura, Pet Detective. He directed The Nutty Professor, just so many amazing movies. And then he moved to Memphis and really invested himself in the community and really is just, in my mind, one of the greats. He's basically given back so much. And he recently directed the film Brian Banks, if you heard about that. So we're going to talk about comedy and history and the light and dark of the creative process. We'll have more guests to announce, but Tom Shadyac, I'd come just to see him if I weren't on the podcast. I guess I'll be there anyway. So so we'd love it if you can come out of that. So we got that, and then we've got Minneapolis, the comedy festival there. That's in June. So just go to roadtonow.com. And all of that information is there at the live events tab at the top of the page. Now, before we move on, I want to say a word about our sponsors, La Cosecha Coffee Roasters. This is the greatest thing that we have advertisers whose products I actually love. You've heard me say this a bunch of times, but I don't drink a ton of coffee. But when I do, I like to drink really good coffee. And so basically, when I drink a cup of coffee now, I drink La Cosecha coffee. It's amazing. Their blends are fantastic. They have direct relationships with a lot of their growers. They really, really, really care about the quality of the coffee and the lifestyle that's being provided by the crop itself. They're a small company based just outside of St. Louis, one shop. They do everything right there, hands-on. And we just really admire them as business owners, and we love their coffee. So if you want to find out why we love them so much, go to their website, LaCosechaCoffee.com. That's LaCosechaCoffee.com. Check out all their blends. They've actually got a special Road to Now kit where you can get La Cosecha coffee and a Road to Now mug all in one. But just go there. And if you don't believe me, just go to their website. Go to LaCosechaCoffee.com. Look at their blends and see the way they're described. And yeah, I think you'll see what I'm talking about there. My favorite right now is available in the single origin sampler pack. They don't have the pounds available, but I would order the whole thing just for this. It's called the Burundi Kirimiro. And here's the description: medium roast and body with notes of sweet tea, tangerine and spice with an earthy finish. It's fantastic. And you can get that as part of the single origin sampler pack. Best part, if you go there and you go to the end of the promo code when you check out and you enter promo code RTN10, that's RTN and the number 10, you get 10% off your coffee order at La Cosecha Coffee Roasters. So please go there. Jamie Jeschke, the owner, and his family, they came through Nashville. We hung out, and the quality of the product and the quality of the people are top notch. So we hope you'll check them out. And so now we hope you enjoy this episode. And I will say now that at the end, there is going to be a little bit more. I'm going to record a little bit more fill-in information and more about Dr. Hanchett and about Pam Kelly. So we hope you enjoy this. And I'm going to try to answer some more questions at the end. If you have any more, hit us up at @road_2_now on Twitter and Instagram. We're also on Facebook. Come find us. We're there.
Welcome to Charlotte. Thank you. We got a really great show for you tonight. We have a lot of guests, so we got a lot going on. So we got to get right to it. So without further ado, please welcome David Childers.
Well, I grew up on the edge of town, where the stars come out when the sun goes down, and the woods and fields were all around, and the wind blew through with a quiet sound, there on the edge of town. We would play in the scrubby pine, rode our bikes on the power line, swimming and fishing all the time. We hid the dreams no one could find, there on the edge of town. Now the town's still there, but the woods are gone. It's all Walmart where the wild things roam, where a boy and a girl could be alone. They're on the edge of town. I bloodied my nose and my best friends too, fighting over nothing like a couple damn fools. Fell in love with the plumber's daughter, and I got baptized in the river's water, there on the edge of town. Oh, I took it for granted, and that's a shame. I thought that things would stay the same. Hell, all I knew, we were having fun, and I never did see how the end could come, there on the edge of town. Now the town's still there, but the woods are gone. It's all Walmart where the wild things roam, where a boy and a girl could be alone. They're on the edge of town. Thank you kindly. Appreciate it. I want to unplug now. We're good, man. Thank you. Thank y'all.
David Childers, everybody. Please welcome Dr. Ben Sawyer. You know, I grew up in South Jersey, and thank you.
No, don't.
Come on. Jersey, yes.
Oh, that is my mom, and you will only encourage her.
That's true. She's from South Jersey, too. It's the South, and it's New Jersey. It's just like here, but it's in New Jersey. That's what it's just. It's just like that. It's the South of New Jersey. You know that I moved to Charlotte in 1996. Woo! Thank you.
We got a big fan of 1996 around here. We like history, but not that specific about years, honestly.
1996, yeah! Olympics in Atlanta, yeah! And that's why I came down. I studied film and TV production, and we didn't even have a TV studio at the school I went to.
We didn't have a TV station when I was growing up because we were in the country.
But I did this internship, and they said the South is the up-and-coming market. Pack up your car. Get resumes, drive south, knock on doors, hand out resumes. So I come south, and a guy I interned for knew a guy that worked at this company called Creative Post. They worked for ESPN. They made the boxes at the bottom of the basketball game, the graphics. And so I go to meet this guy. I drive down from South Jersey, and I arrive in Charlotte, and it's the last exit in North Carolina. It's like Carowinds Boulevard. And I get in there, and the guy's like, hey, it's nice to meet you, but I'm really busy. I'm going to put you in the room with this guy, Tom, who's being trained on paintbox. They call it a paintbox. So the guy, I'm in this room with this guy, and he's from Jersey. A young guy who's from Jersey. He's like, hey, you're from Jersey? I'm from Jersey. So he's like, what are you doing down here? I tell him. He's like, oh, I know this director who makes TV commercials. He lives, his studio is a couple exits up. He's from Jersey. Go see him. Tell him I sent you. We're from Jersey. So I go, I see this guy, I get work. I'm living and working in North Carolina. I need, the film business is good, but I'm not making enough, to start a new life, essentially. And I go to a restaurant, and I apply for a job at a restaurant. And the manager's like, you're from Jersey? I'm from Jersey. Yes. It took me 3.5 weeks before I met somebody from Charlotte, North Carolina.
I was looking for jobs, and they were just like, where are you from? And I was like, they wouldn't hire me. They were hiring people from Jersey, apparently.
Yeah, well, immigration.
I was going to say carpet bagging, but I didn't, but then I did.
Yeah. But tonight we're going to talk about Charlotte and this region and the different aspects of this region and its history.
Yeah, and as someone who spent their college years renovating houses in Myers Park and around here, I had a pretty unique role in taking down some of that history and then putting it up different. But I'm sure by now the trends have gone. It's probably been undone again. But I did learn a lot from that. Like, for example, Myers Park. What a nightmare. All right. How many Queens Roads are there? Anybody? 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 Got that many fingers? Anybody? As many times as we try to kill Castro, that's how many.
Well, this is another thing about when I came in 96, and I'm working in the film business, I'm a production assistant. And this is before cell phones. And you had pagers at the time. But they would say, and I'm brand new, and I got a map. I don't even have MapQuest at this point. And they're like, go get this. Here's where it is. And I got an old road atlas. And I'm driving Queens Road, and what is this now? I'm on Fairview. Now I'm here, and it was just, what? Why? Who set Charlotte up?
Well, we did that to keep you out, but you people came anyway, so.
How about we introduce our guests?
Let's introduce our guests, because there's actually a cool history behind the whole Queens Road thing, if you don't know it, and we'll get to that.
We will learn it tonight. Our first guest was a reporter for the Charlotte Observer for 30 years. She's also the author of the book Money Rock, A Family Story of Cocaine, Race, and Ambition in the New South. Please welcome Pam Kelly.
Thank you.
Well, Pam, I learned about your book from Scott Avett.
I love that.
And he, when he discovers something, it's like he discovered it. So this fall, I go on the road. He's like, man, I'm reading this book. It's incredible. It's about, Charlotte and da-da-da-da. He's telling me the history. We're going to get into the book. I don't want to give details away at this point. But I'm thinking, when he's telling me about your book,
I'm thinking of another guest we're having on in just a few minutes, Thomas Hanchett, and his book, which is it's a history book about the formation of this city. And your book kind of put the people in the history, if that makes any sense.
And for those of us who were here before 1996, we've seen Charlotte change a lot. I mean, I grew up here, you know, like I was born in the Presbyterian Hospital in 1978. And we used to come here, and it's funny because like my mom's sister lived in Charlotte. So we'd make those drives from like Concord, Mount Pleasant out to Charlotte. And the distance between, like the darkness, right, where you'd leave and there'd be no lights, it just got shorter and shorter and shorter, and the roads got wider. So for those of us who, like, I mean, I don't remember it, right, obviously, like, what was it like in 1981 when you first came to Charlotte? What did you see as someone who was from somewhere else?
Well, I came from a pretty small town, so I actually thought Charlotte was pretty cool. But like a lot of American cities, I think, and at that time, downtown was pretty dead. Very few people lived in the downtown area. The thing about it, when I look back, that is one of the biggest changes, is maybe not immediately visible. And that is the fact that when I came to Charlotte in 1981, the schools were integrated. We had busing, probably a lot of you remember this. And Charlotte was like a national beacon of integration and was pretty proud of itself. And that has changed. The schools are no longer very integrated. They've segregated quite a bit.
I think that's a fascinating response from a journalist. You know, you talk to almost anyone, and like the visual difference between 81, the skyline, and mm-hmm. the city exploding in those years. I think that's what we see when we look at it. And from someone who's like on the inside, seeing that.
Well, and also the food. I mean, it's gotten a lot better. You know, our food critic at the Observer back in those years, you know, bless her heart, you know, I remember she reviewed the salad bar at Shoney's once.
I'll bet Shoney's is glad to have more restaurants so it doesn't end up in the review section.
During your early years at the Observer, you interviewed a young man named Belton Lamont Platt. His street name was Money Rock,
right,
and he was a drug dealer.
Mm-hmm.
Three decades later, you wrote a book about him that is, like we said, it's another history of Charlotte. Can you tell us how you first came to meet Money Rock?
Sure, yeah. So I was a young reporter covering courts, and Money Rock had been involved in a major shootout in Piedmont Courts, which no longer exists, but was at Siegel and 10th, not that far from here. And so I first saw him in the courtroom. I covered his trial. He was convicted and first met him actually at Central Prison. I wanted an interview with him because I really wanted to find out about the guy he had the shootout with, who I saw as more of the heavy. That was Big Lou.
Right. Tell us about Big Lou, because when you read the book, I mean, the character studies in this book are impeccable. So tell us a little bit about Big Lou.
Well, Big Lou really had, I mean, the interesting thing when I talked to people in Piedmont Courts, Big Lou was really feared, and he had been charged with all kinds of crimes, never served any time, I think a lot of times because the witnesses were afraid to testify against him. Money Rock didn't have a record, and the people in Piedmont Courts actually kind of liked him. They thought he was really polite. He would say, yes, ma'am, and yes, sir. And so I was thrilled when I got this interview. I thought that he was going to spill the beans and tell me the inside story of this drug turf war that had gone on. And actually, when I got to Central Prison, it turned out that was not the case. He told me he was innocent. He told me not much of value. But the one thing that that he told me that I did use in the story was his description of Big Lou. He described him as kind of like a dinosaur, you know, big old body, little old brain. So I wrote this story, and it was called Money Rock and Big Lou, Portrait of a Shootout. And it ran on the front page on a Sunday. And then I forgot about him, went on to other stories, other beats. And then in 2011, I was actually covering books and for the Observer. And my daughter wanted for Christmas, Jay-Z's memoir, Decoded. And you guys probably know Jay-Z started out as a crack dealer and grew up in public housing. And I was flipping through the book and kind of reading it after I bought it and read this description of growing up in the projects, and it just brought back Piedmont Courts, and it sounded so much the same. And it made me wonder, whatever happened to Money Rock and Big Lou? And also, whatever happened to cocaine? Because there were like several years where, you know, we were covering stories about cocaine arrest constantly. And I realized like I hadn't heard a thing about it, you know, for a long time. So I kind of on a whim decided to see if I could find him. And I got a researcher at the paper to track him down. She got a phone number. He was recently out of federal prison. I called him. He remembered me. And he said, I've been wanting somebody to tell my story. So
what's fascinating when you read this book is you telling his mother's story.
Yeah.
She was an incredible woman.
Yeah. Actually, it's her birthday today. She's 84. She was a really pretty well-known activist in Charlotte. She, you know, lived in public housing. She was poor. And her name is Carrie Graves. And Carrie could talk about anything. And she became the go-to person for the journalist who, like, if you needed a poor person or a black person, people called Carrie. And she really, you know, I went back and read her, all the quotes in different stories. And I mean, she was like so ahead of her time on many issues, you know, it's really amazing. And she's still pretty interested in politics and plans to protest at the Republican convention.
Well, we're going to get into... There we go. Before we get too deep into the history of Charlotte, I would like to introduce to the stage our second guest for this panel, a man who spent 16 years working as the staff historian at the Levine Museum of the New South, and whose book just came out in second edition, Sorting Out the New South City, one of my favorite books I read when I was in grad school at Appalachian State. Please welcome to the stage Dr. Thomas Hanchett.
Welcome, Tom.
Tom, actually many years ago, took a chance on a young podcast that was just starting out.
And look where they are now.
That's right.
give him a round of applause. Isn't he just...
So when we get into the story of Money Rock, what's fascinating about it is a story that brings together the urban environment with the greater picture of the history, social relations. You talk about how the city was proud of its record with busing and with integration of schools, yet the story you tell about Charlotte at the time is one that doesn't actually show that that integration took place. It's very clear that these folks were marginalized, put into a place based on race. Could you talk a little bit about that story and how the lived life of Money Rock can tell you more about it?
Yeah, I've thought about this a lot. I think that, I think busing was a good thing, and I'm sorry that the school system could keep some sort of something that integrated the schools. But the problem was busing was always a proxy because housing was still segregated. Neighborhoods were still segregated. And that's what you see in my book, that Belton and his family lived in, you know, black public housing. And he did went to Myers Park Elementary School. But his world was very segregated. And
For those who are here, could you tell us where you're talking about geographically?
Dalton Village was in West Charlotte off of West Boulevard. And it's still there, but it's been renamed, and I can't think of the name. And then Myers Park Elementary is, again, near here.
Southeast.
Yeah.
One is west, one is southeast.
But so what happened was in most of the black neighborhoods were on the west side. So, and there just wasn't, except for school, there wasn't a lot of interaction. Churches were pretty segregated. Still are.
Tom, one of the great things your book does is it talks about how Charlotte came to be segregated.
Yeah, I always assumed that segregation was something that had always been, or it had started in right after the Civil War in 1865 or after Reconstruction in the 1870s. But it really wasn't until around 1900 that you started to get these very separate parts of town. And it wasn't like just one moment at which the government decided that. It was a whole bunch of decisions that continued all the way through the 20th century. Ironically, in the 1960s, we were getting more segregated residentially, even as the civil rights movement was trying to bring us together in other ways.
So let's back up for a minute. Let's talk about some of those major signposts along the way to segregation.
Well, as recently as 1900, Charlotte pretty much looked like salt and pepper. Very few immigrants in the South at all at that point, and so it's mostly native-born black folks, native-born white folks, and they're everywhere. There's no exclusive well-to-do neighborhoods. There's no exclusively white neighborhoods. 1890s is a time a little bit like now when there was a tremendous economic shock. There was a depression in the early 1890s, and could just be me, but has politics gotten uglier since 2008? Same thing often happens when there's an economic downturn. People look for folks to blame. And politicians can work that. And that's what happened here around 1900, where there was something literally called the White Supremacy Campaign of 1898. It resulted in North Carolina and most other southern states rewriting their constitutions so that you had to pay to vote, which not only locked out a lot of former enslaved folks, but also a lot of working class white folks. And you also had passed something called a literacy test, which meant if they didn't want you to vote, you didn't vote. And so that starts around 1900, and then stuff gets layered on top of it. A thing called redlining in the 1930s, Great Depression. They're trying to help banks make loans. They map good credit risk neighborhoods, which are all in Southeast Charlotte, all white. And then the rest of the city is designated as a bad credit risk neighborhood. 1960s, you get something called urban renewal, where they wipe out blighted neighborhoods. Well, guess which neighborhoods those are? Neighborhoods that were redlined back in the 1930s. And here in Charlotte, the Brooklyn neighborhood, there's a wonderful exhibit at Levine Museum of the New South. Brooklyn was a city within a city here, black Main Street, black churches, 1,000 families displaced, no new housing built, 200 businesses closed, dozen churches kicked out. And so you pile all this stuff up, and Charlotte's not unusual in this. It's an American story. And you end up with this world in which so many of us are afraid that if people unlike us move into our neighborhood, our property values will collapse. And that's really something we've learned. It's not something that's intrinsic.
The history of redlining, which, by the way, was part of, as your book's called, Sorting Out the City, it's amazing how that goes on. A couple of months ago, we were in Chicago, and we spoke with Aaron Welsh, who's an epidemiologist. And a lot of people, this is what gets me, is that a lot of times people want to say, well, that happened before. But the city was drawn, the lines were drawn around it. People were allocated based upon how much money they had. Because race and class are so highly correlated, those became largely black neighborhoods. And folks still live along that pattern. Now, it has mixed up some since then, but you still have neighborhoods that have been poor and black since that point. Today, you can go and draw a line across, basically put that map from the 1930s and 40s over cities and see where the lead poisoning rates are. Because in the areas where they were drawn for the poorer folks, today the incidence of lead poisoning is higher. It is amazing how these things live on.
And you can also take those redlining maps and then put the urban renewal maps, and in those redlined neighborhoods, they were the ones that got destroyed and people displaced when they rebuilt cities, when the cities got government money to rebuild and to improve neighborhoods. What they did was they just demolished what we would consider the ghetto.
So, Pam, this is where we kind of backed up and given this overview. Where within this greater history does the story that you tell fit?
You know, I started out, I wrote a series for The Observer, so it was more tightly focused on this Money Rock and his redemption. You know, he changed. But when I went to write the book, I wanted to do something broader and bring the city into it more. And I mean, what I found is, as I told these people's stories, all this history just naturally correlated. Like, for instance, Carrie, you know, she went to church in Brooklyn, the neighborhood that, and she lived in Cherry, a neighborhood that's now very gentrified, but it was kind of where a lot of the working class black families lived. So you could tell this whole, you know, I could kind of tell this story, and I had great help from Tom, by the way, but I could tell this story about Charlotte through these people.
So while you were writing your book, you were discussing
yeah,
with Tom.
Yeah, yeah,
and were you ever like, one day maybe we'll be on a show together? And
we yeah. were hoping that they would invent podcasts and we could be on one.
But I mean, I think you talked about kind of, you know, bringing the people in. Like, I felt like I knew a lot because I'd been a reporter here a long time. But hearing some people's stories, I mean, it really just brought home the segregation and also the difference in, you know, white poor and black poor. For instance, one guy I quote in the book, Arthur Griffin, he grew up in a black neighborhood. No, it's not Second Ward. He grew up in First Ward. Right. But he talked about being at this black elementary school and looking over at Piedmont Courts, which at the time was, it started out as public housing only for white people. And he would look over at Piedmont Courts and think that those were the rich people because his mother cleaned houses for them.
So kind of on the outside looking in and not understanding what their life is like, but just imagining, you know.
I think the fact that they could hire his mom as a maid tells you that, you know, there's a difference.
A different structure of opportunity, yeah. as the scholars say now. Yeah.
Yes, I think that nailed it, Tom. That nailed it. One last question I have about the book in particular. The thing that caught me is when the book opens up, you bring it in on, you know, your story starts with the crack wars, right? With the war on drugs, and or not really starts, but that's where it's focused, right? Mm-hmm. That's where you have the story of Money Rock beginning with that shootout with Big Lou, right?
Right.
And so what blew my mind was your kind of small history of cocaine to that point. And how prior to the war on drugs in the 1980s, when crack became a thing, cocaine was really not considered to be like a taboo thing.
It had a cool period. And yeah, in the late 70s, there was this Newsweek story that you find cited a lot. And it talks about how cocaine is really the latest thing now with the jet set hostesses in New York and LA, and they, you know, at their dinner parties, they might serve it with the beluga caviar and on the silver tray, and it's just really cool. Like, it's like a new fad. And then, as I was doing my research, I found about that same time, 1977, a Charlotte News story that localized it, you know, the good local angle. So they found local people using cocaine.
You can find them. They're like, nah.
And quoted them about, you know, and they were basically professional people. And they talked about how all these professional people were using it and quotes this guy, unnamed, who says, you know, cocaine's probably the most sociable high in the world. And it's just amazing, you know, that... yeah, it was.
Some guy was getting up on Sunday morning reading the newspaper, being like, "Darling, we need to check this cocaine out." Sounds fantastic. And then suddenly, boom! It is war on drugs. Can you talk about the differences between the story of cocaine and the story of crack?
Well, by 85, actually, right around the time of the shootout, it was the first front page story in the New York Times about crack. And how it was, I think it had started, it was this, and first of all, you know, you probably know this, but crack and cocaine are the same thing. Crack is just a cooked form of cocaine. But, you know, crack is really the equivalent of moonshine versus...
Stick around for the second half of the show.
Yeah, it all comes together. But if you're, you know, if you don't have a lot of money and you want a good high, you know, you don't want to fool around with a, you know, Michelob Light. You just go so crack was for people who didn't have as much money. So it was basically when black people started using it, and there was more violence there in terms of the sales and gangs and, and then suddenly it was the worst thing ever. And like 10 years after it was cool, Newsweek was saying it was equivalent to the plagues of the Middle Ages. And then by 89, like in national polls, Americans said illegal drugs were the biggest problem facing America, like by a huge percentage, which I just find fascinating now.
Tom, you're an urban historian. So what can you tell us about the growth of the city? So we talked about how you could go down a street and then it's, all of a sudden the name changes. There's a reason for that. And then when I got here in the 90s, it was a boom time, you know, for, I mean, the economy was doing incredible. I mean, that's why you had so many people from New Jersey and Ohio, and the banks were doing great and everything. And there was a lot of growth. And everyone, when I lived here in the 90s, said, this is going to be like Atlanta. Someday we're going to be like Atlanta. And then I left Charlotte in 2003, and I came back when my daughter got sick. We were at Levine Children's Hospital in 2011, and it really had, at that point, I recognized the city, but it had become a lot of the things that they predicted. Talk about the development.
But not quite Atlanta.
Right.
Yeah, we now roll our eyes about becoming Atlanta. Back in the 80s, people really did want to become Atlanta, which was pretty amazing. 1990, Mecklenburg County, which is the now urbanized county around Charlotte, including Charlotte, had 500,000 people. 1990, just hit 1 million. So if you're out driving on 77 and it seems like they're all in front of you, it's a real thing. The amazing thing that Charlotte has done is it's mostly gotten ahead of that growth in terms of building highways and building light rail and adding professional sports and more hospitals and all that sort of thing. So the change here, the pace of change, really still blows me away.
Before we leave with the two of you, I've got a big question, okay? So here's the thing. Charlotte. It's a city. Most of you guys live here. That's great. But when you think about Charlotte, what's the thing, right? It's like a lot of southern cities, they have their thing, right? Like you think about Nashville, you think about country music, right? You think about Atlanta, you think about traffic. Like what is Charlotte's thing that like sets it apart? Because like I've asked people this and they're like, Tar Heels? And I'm like, no, that's like a while. And also, no, that's not right either. But it's like I ask people and they're like, you know, like somebody like last year was like Charlotte Bobcats, and I was like, they're gone too. All right. Like everything that people think about, and like the best they come up with is banks. And I'm like, is that what we want? It's like it's a place where money turns into more money, which actually does sound awesome. Never mind. But like, so like if you both of you as experts, you spent your lives here, studying here, you know, talking to the people. If you could say, like, what, is there a queen of Charlotte now, whatever it is, if they were right here, right now, and you could say, like, here's what we think people should think of when they think of Charlotte, what do you think it would be? And we'll start with Pam.
It's tough. What comes to mind is the aspirations. Charlotte's just always aspiring to be more. And, you know, and I think about the Republican National Convention, and I think the fact that Charlotte was the only city that actually bid for it. I mean, I think Charlotte thought they were...
We got it.
Yeah. but didn't want to miss out.
Well, they had the DNC here a few years ago, too.
Yeah.
Do you tell them they were the only ones? Or do you like, congratulations, guys? Like, I don't even know how you approach
it's
that.
It's kind of funny if you think about it, they're the only ones that bid for it.
I think they got kind of, I mean, I think there were several other cities they were like, well, you know, and I can't remember what the Las Vegas wants it, you know. But in the end, Charlotte was the only one that bid.
Okay, so you think.
But Charlotte is just always wanting to be more.
Okay. So if you're Chamber of Commerce, Charlotte, city of aspirations.
Yeah, that doesn't really work. Yeah.
Tom?
Charlotte, don't worry. You'll be better. Just keep going.
Well, I think there's something actually to that this is a place that's growing, and it's a place with a lot of possibility. And I'm not a branding person, and so I'm not thinking in terms of branding. What would I like Charlotte to be known for? A generation ago, we were the city that made integration work. We were written up in Time magazine. Some of that energy is still here, which is kind of cool. And you see it in the way that we're dealing with affordable housing. Like a lot of American cities, folks with money and choice are moving in. older neighborhoods, any place within 4 or 5 miles of the center city, prices are rising, people are getting pushed out. That's threatening to tear apart cities like San Francisco. Here, Mayor Vi Lyles put a bond issue together, $50 million. Voters approved it overwhelmingly. They didn't approve anything else overwhelmingly. A couple of years ago, the Philanthropic Community Foundation of the Carolinas has more than doubled that. I don't know how we match up against other cities in the United States, but we're a city that's actually tackling that. In San Francisco, they're tearing apart each other over whether they should and how they should. Here, we're doing it. And so some of that has to do with this legacy of busing. This is a city where the leadership talks with each other. That's a Southern thing. And so, you know, I would love us to be known as the city that tackled a problem like that and made a good city for everybody.
That's awesome. Right.
Pam Kelly, Tom Hanchett, thank you guys so much for being here.
And copies of books, their books are for sale at the merch stand. We hope you'll check them out.
Thank you.
All right, so that episode was so great, and listening back to it, all I can think about is all the questions I wanted to ask. There's so many more. First of all, I want to say that Pam Kelly's book, Money Rock, is fantastic. You can find it on any online bookseller or at your local bookstore. Go check it out. One of the things that we really didn't cover in there is that the subject she studies in the book, Money Rock himself, ends up becoming a preacher and really turning his life around. And the story of his life and the story of her life and the way they intertwine is really fantastic. In fact, when the book first came out, they did some speaking tours together, which is a really beautiful ending to the story. And I think a really hopeful story about how people change and how things can get better and how that usually happens when we try to make them better. So it's a beautiful story. I'll also say, man, since that show, I actually got the second edition of Thomas Hanchett's Sorting Out the New South City, the book he wrote. And just the preface to the new edition, the second edition, is just amazing. I love this book, as I said. It's one of my favorite urban histories. Just sitting down and reading through it, really, I can't recommend it enough, especially if you live in Charlotte. It will, there's so much more we didn't cover here that will just absolutely expand your mind about it. Or if you don't even live there, if you're just interested in cities, it's really, really a great book. Also, you may have noticed that there is some beautiful music at the beginning of this episode, and there is, and that is from our friend David Childers, who actually opened up both the Charlotte and the Carrboro shows for us. David has been a friend of Bob's for a long time. They had a band together called the Over Mountain Men, which I love. And so we were lucky enough to have David come out. And if you enjoyed the music, highly suggest that you check out his album. It's now streaming. The new album is called Interstate Lullaby. It just came out. It is beautiful. And you can get that anywhere you get streaming music. You can go to ramzerrecords.com and find out more about it there. Or you can go to David's website, davidchilders.com. That's davidchilders.com. The man is a legend. It was great to work with him. And we hope you enjoyed his music here and that you will follow up by checking him out because the man is awesome. I also want to say one thing. We said at the beginning that we were going to answer the question about why there's so many Queens Roads and why Myers Park is so confusing. And then we never got to it in the interview. So I will actually give you a quick summary here. And this actually in Thomas Hanchett's book. You can check it out there. But the answer to the question of why this neighborhood and so many other ones that are similarly designed in the era are confusing is because they're built that way intentionally. One of the things that was happened in the 19th century, a lot of cities that were being built, especially new cities, were built on grids. And grids are really familiar and easy to get in and out of. And that's if you live there, but also if you don't live there. Like if you live in a place like New York where it's just like streets and avenues, you really can't get lost, and you can really find your way from one place to the other and know the place. But at the time that Myers Park was built, and this was going on in the 1910s, the first couple years of that, a designer named John Nolan came in. And one of Nolan's ideas was to kind of make the neighborhoods he designed and the nature flow with one another, but also to make places that were difficult to navigate if you weren't from there.
If you've ever been to Myers Park in Charlotte, you'll know there are these big wide roads that run through the middle that have multiple names that are kind of the same name. And then on the back roads, there are these small roads that I remember when I used to build houses there, we would say, who the heck designed these roads? You can't get two cars past each other. And we're like, why would you do this? And that was intentional. The purpose was to have big roads that people could kind of find their way around if they somewhat knew it. But then all the other roads were not meant to be really driven down for traffic. Nolan's quote was, not all roads are carriers of traffic. Some roads merely lead to the home. So you have these small roads in the back, wide roads out front, not following traditional patterns, but deliberately so. And what you do when you do that is that a time of increased transportation, a time of increased mobility where people could get to your neighborhood, if they don't know the neighborhood, it's obvious. It's not very easy for someone from the outside just to walk in there. And that's really what it was about creating places that were beautiful, but also were just for the people who live there. And at a time of growing segregation along racial and economic lines, people wanted the security. A lot of them did. They've just known that somebody who wasn't one of them wasn't going to be there unless they were supposed to be there. Usually meant they were serving them or in some way. So there's your answer to it. A lot of the things that seem to be confusing and baffling in life are that way, and sometimes they're deliberately so. Goes back to mapping in general. You know, Lewis and Clark had to go out west, and I always ask my students, you know, why weren't there maps before they mapped it? And they have a lot of good ideas, but the real answer is you don't need a map of the place that you live. Maps are for outsiders. Same thing with familiarity of roads. After a while, a place that seems confusing when you first get there actually makes sense if you're there a lot. So there you go. I hope that you enjoyed this live conversation. Again, my thanks to everyone who came out. Thanks from Bob as well. These live shows have been amazing, and we hope to see you at one coming up, either Nashville in April or Minneapolis in June, or maybe on one of the other ones we have planned that we haven't announced yet. Just saying. So keep your eyes peeled to theroadtonow.com, live events tab at the top of the page, and hopefully we'll come near you. So thank you so much for listening. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Road to Now. The Road to Now is hosted and produced by Bob Crawford and Dr. Benjamin Sawyer. This episode was edited by Gary Fletcher. Our social media manager is Austin Sawyer, and today's music is by Paul DeFiglia. If you have not gone and rated us on iTunes, please do so. We need you to do that so we can spread the word about this podcast. Everyone who has, we say thank you. Speaking of thanks, we'd like to say a special thanks to everyone on Patreon who helps make this podcast possible, with a special shout out to our Washingtonians, Tanya Marsh, Mary Hawking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Fig White, Jeff LeCain, Peggy Donica, Susan Sharp, Joseph Mann, Matt Williams, and Mariah Wolford. If you'd like to join our community of patrons and get lots of extra content, just go to patreon.com/theroadtonow and pick a tier. For as little as $5 a month, you get access to episodes 1 through 75, some extras, bonus content, and it only gets better from there. For Bob Crawford, this is Ben Sawyer. Thanks for listening, and take care.